Chats, the show where I, Josh Pickford, founder of Baremetrics, hop on a call with other founders and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with Rob Walling, founder of Drip. We talk about growing up in the country, learning programming, getting into entrepreneurship as a kid, buying existing businesses and improving them, the origin of Drip and its acquisition by LeadPages, and a whole lot more. Enjoy. Hey, Rob, how's it going, man?
It's going well. Thanks for having me on the show, man.
Absolutely. So the way that I like to kind of kick these things off is starting off with you as a kid. What was your childhood like?
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. I don't talk about this much. My childhood, two parents, we lived, I was the youngest of four kids, and my parents stayed together until I was married, actually. And then they split up right around that time. So I had a very stable upbringing. Dad was an electrician. Mom was a homemaker. So, kind of a working class upbringing. And we lived in the East Bay area of California. So like an hour east of San Francisco. So I was just close enough that like we caught the ripples of like when Apple Computer started getting big. I mean, that was, 20 miles from my house. But I was far enough away that like, I didn't feel like I was immersed in all of that. And when we'd go into the city, as we call it, San Francisco, I'd be amazed at all these billboards, for like biotech and Apple and IBM clones and all that.
Were you into technology as a kid?
So yes, I was, is the short answer. So I'm going to be 44 this year. So for me, there was not much technology until I was like 8 years old, which is when we got an Apple IIe. And that was really what kicked it off. Before then, it was tons of Legos and writing. I used to write fiction, tons of reading. I mean, that's what I did when I was young. It was just a mad. We lived in the country, even though it was in the Bay Area. It was our nearest neighbor was half mile. We were bused, into a local school. So it wasn't like we had friends outside of school. We never did play dates or hung out at kids' houses. As a result, my brother and I had four siblings, but the two oldest were a lot older, right? And they moved out when I was young. But my brother and I, who are about 4 years apart, we just had a ton of time to ourselves. So we just consumed all kinds of books, ranging from fiction, nonfiction. And in looking back, I think about all this stuff. We had no TV reception. There was no cable because we lived too far in the country and the cable guys wouldn't bring it down. So I watched PBS like 3-4 hours a day. And it's shocking how much stuff I learned from that. And by the time I was in third or fourth grade, I remember thinking, why doesn't everybody know all this stuff, about Earth's rotation? But they just hadn't been, they hadn't been watching that, right? They'd been watching Disney Channel or whatever was available. So it was this interesting kind of shift. So when a computer came along, which was really expensive, right, it was like $4,000, which again, my dad, electrician, they plunked it down for my parents plunked it down for me and my brother to get that computer. And we were like, what? There's ways we can like create games just by typing this text. And so we learned BASIC, and the games are too expensive to buy, right? They were $50, $60 a piece, which is way out of our price range in 1982, I think that would be. So we decided to make our own text games, and that was the kickoff for me of like, this stuff is amazing.
So how did you teach yourself BASIC? Just like books from the library kind of thing?
Yeah, really, we got one book from the computer store called I Speak BASIC to My Apple. And we read that cover to cover. And it's funny, it's like simpler times, man. I'm sure today it would be awesome to have, or back then it would have been awesome to have all the, the code academies and all the online coding schools. But there was a simplicity and like a self-starterness of it that like we just dug in and we read that same damn book over and over and over. And each time learned a little more and a little more and became really masterful at in other ways, simple programming language. And then, we hit the library at one point, which was, 20-minute drive from our house. And I remember we got one more book and it like blew our horizons wide open. It's like, we didn't even know it was subroutines. Like you can write subroutines and functions, or something. It was like, this is so crazy, that you don't just have this long string of code. And each iteration was like, totally earth shattering to us.
So your dad was an electrician, but was he into computers or was it just sort of, he knew that you guys would probably dig having a computer?
He was not neither he nor my mom were into computers at all. And they never knew how to use it. They would sit there and watch us do it and just kind of look right. and be like, well, what are you doing now? What are you doing? I have no idea what you're doing. You know, it was, I think, an intentional decision. He was like, I think this is the future. I see them at work. You know, he saw them in the office. They were kind of running right. the business on it. And he's like, you guys just need some exposure to this stuff. And which in retrospect was a pretty good call, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So what was school like for you? Were you a good student? Did you not care about school, or how did that go for you?
Yeah, I was. So I had the knowledge just from constantly thinking about this stuff, you know, constantly taking in facts and all that stuff, and had a pretty good memory. And I cared about school, which I think are the two things you need, right? Because I knew kids who were as smart or smarter than I was, but they didn't care. And I also knew kids who cared, but they just didn't have all the information or couldn't retain it as much. And it's like, those were the two factors that I had. So yeah, I did quite well in school. I went to this really tiny school. It was about 100 kids, I think, and it was K-8. And maybe it was 150 by the time I left. Very small classes, like 6-8 person classes. It was a public right. school. It was just out in the middle of nowhere. And good teachers. And so I remember coming into third grade, I believe, and then I would go like to fifth grade math or sixth grade math. And then I'd go to like fifth grade language arts and then third grade for PE, you know, and I just kind of bounce around. And my parents never wanted me to skip grades because, frankly, I'm a little, you know, physically, I'm not super gifted like an athlete. So they knew it's like, this kid's going to be behind in that anyways. Yeah. We don't want him to be this like 14-year-old high school senior, you know?
Right.
So, which was a great call. It didn't make much sense to me at the time, but it's like, I think high school kind of sucked anyways, but at least it was tolerable yeah. that I wasn't younger than everybody, sure. you know?
Yeah. So were the people around you into computers as well?
No. Not until, I think it was maybe sixth or seventh grade. So again, you know, I got it when I was 8, so that would have been third grade. And it was right around, let's say fifth, sometime like fourth or fifth grade, where like Apple Computer donated an Apple IIe to every school in the state of California. And they did it on purpose to get schools, you know, to get school children exposed to it so that they would go home and say, I want this Apple IIe.
Sure.
Then our school got some budget a couple years later to buy some. And I remember my brother may have been in high school by that time, but when I got there, I was like, oh yeah, I know how to do this. I know how to program it. I know how to like copy files. I know how to pirate little floppy disks. You know, I mean, knew the whole right. jam. And yeah. there were other kids who had never, like literally never seen one. And I realized the impact. I was not smug about it at all, right? I wasn't like, oh, I know much more than everybody else. I remember being so thankful that like my parents had done that for me and it yeah. occurring. And I was, you know, helping other people. I already knew how to type. I mean, you know how you just learn sometimes like through sure. osmosis. Whereas other kids were doing typing tutors and struggling to like learn it. And I remember just being like, man, I just caught this wave, you know? So no, the answer is no, but I did have one teacher. He was like, his name was Mr. Mumford. He was like a sixth or seventh grade teacher, and he was into it and would nerd out with me about it. And that was about it until probably college, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you have any sort of entrepreneurial bent as a kid? I mean, were you the kid like, you know, cutting yards or selling stuff on the side of the road, whatever?
Yeah. I wish there was like the leaf raking and the, you know, cutting yard stuff, but we live yeah. just too far out in the country. But yeah, I realized early on that like the stuff I wanted, you know, the computer games, even comic books that I was reading, they cost money and we didn't have much. I mean, we got by, it was fine. You know, we never had times where we didn't have enough food or something. But it was definitely, you know, a scarce resource in the house. And I kept trying to figure out how can I make money outside of the house, basically, because my dad did right. pay us. He paid us a dollar an hour to whack weeds, and because we had yeah. this big property, and we did that. I mean, I would go out in the summer 8 hours a day and whack the weeds for a week and make $40, and it was like that was something. But I knew that was not the way I was going to make enough, you know, to kind of do what I wanted. So I did buy candy at, I believe it was Pack and Save. I don't remember if Costco or Price Club were around then, but I bought candy in bulk and sold it at school. And I remember buying Now and Later packs, the small ones, for like 3 cents uh-huh. a piece. Well, I spent $3 for 100. Is that right? Yeah. I'm trying to think of what it was, something like that.
Yep.
And it would have been $30 for 100. Now, whatever the price was, I remember buying them for like 3 cents a piece and selling them for 25 cents a piece. Right. So like eight yep. times markup, but 25 cents seemed totally logical. And so I made I think I paid $3 and I walked away with $25 at the end, which, and now I was like, boy, I can get behind this. And at the time, it was, you know, it was some decent money. And then I moved from there to actually selling, marking up comic books, because I was one of the only kids that went on a recurring basis. And so I would take orders and I'd mark up maybe 20% and sell them at school.
What do you think like made you go the route? I mean, obviously there's so many different angles that you can take for making money from a business perspective, but for you it was, let me buy this thing and resell it. So what do you think made you go that route instead of sort of, I mean, I don't know, what would the, instead of services or something, you know, like somebody paying you to do something?
Well, I think I had the option to do the services at my own house. Like my dad basically said, there's always stuff to do, work, you know, there's always work to do at the house, and I'll pay you this dollar an hour, which wasn't a lot of money even then, in all honesty. I mean, it was probably what a 10-year-old kid deserved, but it really felt like, oh, I'm never going to make anything. And there was something, I felt like I could make more money faster, I think. And it was a gamble. There was some stuff I bought. Like I remember buying these globes filled with slime, and I split the slime up so to try to sell them for, you know, basically I paid 50 cents and I was going to sell each one for 50 cents. So I was going to double my money, and like no one wanted to buy it. And I was devastated. My dad's like, dude, you lost 50 cents. Like you need to chill. Business ventures will do this sometimes. Didn't you just make like $20, you know, from the now and laters? And I was yes, I did. So the fact that it had early success and that, you know, it kind of made more money based on the time investment. Cause to make 25, sure, 20 bucks would have been 20 hours of work on a weekend, which would have been a ton of work for me. So I think that was really my one option, you know, was kind of selling things. Again, there wasn't a, hey, I'll rake your leaves for $5, you know, or mow the lawn like other kids may have had the option to do.
Right. So, high school at that point, let's see, the internet still would not have.
That's right.
Been a thing.
I am that. Thanks for pointing that out. I am that old. So high school was 89 to 93 for me. Yeah, it was also college that I had my first email address.
Okay, yeah. Got it. So, did your sort of love for computers? I mean, you went to college and majored in
electrical engineering and computer engineering. Two majors. Yeah, double majors. So
I'm assuming the computer stuff stuck all through high school and then obviously in the college as well.
Well, that's the interesting thing is I stopped hacking. You know, I wasn't even really coding much. It was like hacking scripts, you know, in seventh or eighth grade, other people weren't into it. And then in high school, you were a nerd if you did that stuff. And it was really frowned upon. Like today it's cool to do. And it was not at all. And I got interested in sports, played football. I ran track, got interested in girls. Got interested in just hammering out the schoolwork, hanging out with friends, and really didn't touch the computer much aside from to play some games like Bard's Tale and such, you know, adventure games. But I didn't code at all until college. And in college, I was going to do this EE, the electrical engineer major, because my dad was not an engineer, but he was an electrician. And me and my brother were all going to, you know, go and kind of work for the same company and had that plan. My brother also majored in electrical engineering. So I get into University of California, Davis, and they say, look, for another 2 quarters, you can get a computer engineering degree as well. There's so much overlap. And computer engineering is more hardware focused. There's not a ton of software in it, not like computer science. But I did take, you know, I'd say half a dozen coding courses while I was there. And it was C++. It was Pascal, C++. There was Java. There was algorithms. Yeah, it was more than half a dozen as I think about it. There was algorithms. And then there were like data structures, right? It was like you learn how to build a linked list and how to build a hash and all that stuff, dictionaries and such. What I noticed is when in college, I hated programming because it was so structured. And the guy teaching a lot of the courses, rightfully so, like today, I think he's really smart. He had worked for IBM and he said, look, when you write a program with 10,000 lines or 100,000 lines and there's 20 people working on it, you have to structure your code very strictly and you have to have these subroutines or these functions. And I hated that structured style of programming because I was basically a hacker, right? I'd just been hacking my own scripts and I loved the freedom of creating things without these constraints. And as soon as there were constraints on it, I was like, this sucks. I don't want to do this anymore, you know? So I did it for the grade and all on it. You know, I just did it to get the diploma. And it wasn't until after graduation, I went to work for the construction firm, you know, that my dad worked for, made it about about a year before I realized I really didn't like it. And about 6 months later, I quit and got a job for a essentially a consulting firm that was building web apps and websites for .com. So this was like 99, 2000 era.
What were you doing at the construction firm? Electrical engineering?
No, I was in the field. I was out installing and working. Yeah, it's a trip, man. So I'm pretty good with electrical stuff. I mean, I was hanging fixtures and putting it in. So I would, you know, wake up at 5 a.m. and it was a 90-minute commute to work because Bay Area traffic's completely ridiculous, even back then. And then, yeah, I think there was about between four and 6 months that was in the office, and I was learning how to run the business and I was doing project management. And then I was kind of going to do this 1 year internship where I was in the field as an electrician. And I made it through that. And at the end of that, I was like, I don't really like this business. The margins suck. You know, it's just a really slim margin, totally commoditized. I don't really like the people that I work with. And it wasn't the company. It's just like, these are not my people. You know, they're very aggressive. Everything's an argument. Everything's a fight, putting each other down. And it was like, I would prefer to work with people who like want to get along and build stuff together rather than bitch at each other, you know, or try to tear each other down. It felt like being in high school again a little bit, like being on the, on the football team where all the guys are ragging on each other. And that was kind of what a construction site felt like to me. And I was like, I could do the work. It was hard work, but I did it. But it was more like, yeah, I don't think this is my long-term game here, you know?
Right. So in college, when you were doing the computer engineering stuff and even the programming stuff, and you had the internet at your disposal, did you make the connection that, hey, the computers, I'm doing some of the computers and programming, and this could also translate to the web?
A little bit. So by my senior year, so I was in college from 93 to 98. There for 5 years. I ran track and I took that extra year to finish that computer engineering thing. So the web was really coming around, right? I'd say 95, 96, 97. I forget the first time I pulled up Mosaic and then, you know, opened web crawler and stuff. And then when Netscape came out and all that, I remember that. I had no idea it would be as big as it was. I mean, I was not thinking like there should be commerce on the web. but I knew that programming, I mean, I knew that it was code that was making all of the apps work, right? It's like we used, I think it was called Pine. Pine was email, or Pine was like news group surfing, because there were all these news groups, right? And I knew, I was in my head, I was like, I know that this is written in like Pascal or C. You know, I could tell all the prompts and everything. And so I knew that it translated there. And then when I saw the web, I was like, dude, HTML is so simple. And so I made a homepage in like probably 97, you know, really early on, that was like me with pictures of my guitar or something like that. So yeah, I knew it would translate, but I didn't know the potential the web would have. But I will say that during that time, I was on those news groups and I was selling this comic book collection that my brother and I had amassed in the 80s. And I sold that thing a piece at a time for like 2 years. And I paid for all of my non tuition and living expenses, right? So my dad, I got a scholarship, and then my dad helped out with tuition and living, but everything else, like my food and my, I don't know, for my track shoes, you know, I was paying all that through selling
comic books.
Yeah. So it was continuing that thread of entrepreneurship in quotes. It's not like I ran a business that scaled, but I wanted to make money and needed to do it somehow. And I didn't want to take the time away from track and school to get a job. And so this was kind of a side gig for me at the time.
Right. So was the consulting firm that you went to after the construction stuff, was that your first sort of real taste of building something on the web other than, you know, just a simple HTML site?
No, I had built a couple things on my own that I had thought could be this great startup idea. It's, you know, I'm in the Bay Area, 98, 99. I'm going to build something, just completely naive. And learned classic ASP, because this was cutting edge, right? Classic ASP over Access and Access database with Flash. I think it was like Flash 3 or Flash 4 is my memory. And I then brought a friend in, and who had been a mechanical engineer at UC Davis, and we both learned it together. And I said, let's do this and ship this thing. And so we had gotten just enough experience. That's actually what got both of us jobs at like competing web dev firms in Sacramento. We both got a job within the same couple months. And it was purely that, Well, it was our degrees that we had degrees in engineering. And then it was like, yes, you'd build something. And we'd thrown it live, but no one ever, zero people used it. Like we had no idea how to market or do any of that, yeah. You know?
So what's the, how do you make the transition out of doing consulting stuff into doing something for yourself where you're actually able to make money?
Yeah. So for the first couple of years, I really enjoyed. So I was a full-time W-2 employee for that company, but they farmed us out, right? And we were a project firm is really what it was. We were like going to the, you know, to Napa style. I don't know if you've heard of them, but it's, I can't remember his name anymore, but he's like a personality on PBS and he's a chef. And he had this website. And so we were building shopping carts by hand, right? There was no Shopify. It was before all that stuff. So you'd code a shopping cart out of, at that time it was Java or PHP, maybe ASP and Perl even I had to do one side in that. And so I loved it. I loved building and shipping code into production, having people use it. And I took an incredible attention to detail. I had no problem structuring the code. It felt less structured than it had in school. And yet the stuff worked and we were able to maintain it. And I did that for a couple years and was still loving it. And then the company went out of business with the .com bust. And so at that point I was, my wife and I just bought a house literally maybe 60 days before that. We closed on a house. And then the guy says, we're going out of business. Your last paycheck's next week. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm like 20, trying to think how old, 25, 26. And I was like, I don't know what to do, but I need another job. Well, there was no work, right? And I knew that I loved programming at that point. So there's no work. And so the guy who was running the firm, who I'm still in touch with, the firm was about 17 person. And it was a lot of college kids is what it was. A lot of college and just post-college kids. He said, look, I have work for three developers. The whole firm was about 17. He said, I have work for three of you. If you want to do it, like you'll be a contractor for me and we'll just cut the checks in half, basically. Whatever the clients give us, I'll split with you. Which to me, I was like, that's the terrible idea. I need way more security than that. I can't, you know, in retrospect, my attitude was terrible, but I eventually got there when I couldn't get work. And so I said, well, fine, I don't have a job anyways. So he had like a 1 month or 6 week project that I think I was going to make like $6,000 on. You know, it was like a $12,000 project he'd sold. And I was like, sweet, why don't I do that while I'm trying to get W-2 jobs? And I had more fun during that 6 weeks than I ever had working anywhere because I was working from home. I could work until two, three in the morning. It was purely project-based. I enjoy working nights, right? So after dinner, I would go work and then I'd sleep late and I'd have my days free. It was so much freedom. It was my first taste of this ridiculous freedom I'd wanted for years. And that was where I was like, wow, I need to become a contractor. Like I need to never go back, or a consultant, either way, right? I need to never go back to full-time employment. Now, over the next, that was 2001, 2002. So by the time full-time product income was 2008, right? So there's about 7 years. I did go back to W-2 twice during that time. And both times I regretted it. But it was always that grass is greener thing, right? Of like, I'm so sick of consulting. I'm sick of the clients bossing me around. But this job, this job pays $120,000. I'm going to go do that, you know? And I would do it for 7 months. And it's like, why did I do this? This sucks, you know?
That's funny. So in that time where you were kind of hopping back and forth between consulting and being like a W-2 employee, had you been working on your own ideas and your own stuff?
Yeah. So I started probably, there was that one in 99 that we launched to nothing. And then I launched two others, I believe, between 2000 and 2005. And one was, it was called flogs.com. And it was like it was kind of like Dig, but I was restricting it to personal finance news. So for those who don't remember Dig, it's more like Reddit, right? Reddit was kind of kind of a copy of Dig at the time, but it's like Reddit. But I was like, we're only going to have personal finance news. And it's going to be great monetization because personal finance ads are really expensive. You know, this is my diluted thought process at the time. So building a community was insane from scratch. I mean, I did all the wrong things, which was great. Cause then I learned that those were terrible things to do, you know, trying to monetize with ads, I mean, if anything that was going to work, it needed to be a funded thing. Right. And that's something I didn't want to do was sacrifice the time, the flexibility, the location, all that to go try to raise funding for something.
Yeah. So after Flogs, what came next?
Oh, that name kills me. It was with a Z. F-L-O-G-Z. Oh, no. It just gets worse, dude. Oh, it's terrible. So we launched Flogs, and I wound up, how much money do we make off that? I mean, it was definitely a negative by the time I paid a designer and stuff, but like the ad revenue was trivial, but not none. I mean, I made hundreds of dollars from Flogs.com, total lifetime, right? And then I just shut it down and I was like, this is a terrible idea. And then I honestly can't remember. I'd have to look back at like the domain, the Boulevard of Broken Dreams, right? My domain ownership history. But I had something else along similar lines where I was looking around. And it's like, well, everyone's talking about blogging and Web 2.0 and I'm going to do that. But it was like, it was stuff you just kind of couldn't bootstrap. You know, I didn't realize that there were these small ideas and you could just build software for a tiny niche. And that's when I realized, after that, it was like, I need to find something that I can monetize, that I can sell for dollars, that has a really tight niche, not a lot of competition, and be the only player in town and see what I can build it to. And so I started thinking about building invoicing software for for a different vertical, right? Invoicing for whoever. Yeah. I'm sure I came up with dumb ideas like florists and salons and stuff, like dentists, like we all do. And then in 2005, I stumbled upon somebody trying to sell. No. They were looking for a partner to market .NET Invoice. So it was invoicing software written in .NET. It wasn't SaaS, right? There was really no SaaS at the time. I mean, 37 Signals was probably just a glimmer in DHH's and Jason Fried's eye at the time. And this .NET Invoice software was written in .NET, and you downloaded it, installed it on your own server or on your shared hosting account, and then you could basically have kind of a FreshBooks experience that was your own, right? And again, FreshBooks launched a couple years later, so it wasn't like there was competition. And they wanted someone to market it. And I was like, I don't really want to partner with you guys, but would you just sell me the whole thing? And they said it took about 400 hours of their time. They were .NET developers in quotes, and but the UI was really nice at the time. It was Ajaxy, which was just coming about and being a thing. Yeah. And they said 400 hours, and I was doing loose math, and I think I was billing 125 an hour at the time as a consultant, and I was like, that's 50 grand worth of my time. And that was always the thing I struggled with, is I couldn't carve out the hundreds of hours that it would take to get a product to launch. And when I saw this, I was like, dude, 50 grand, that's nuts. Like, if I could get this for even for 10 grand, it would be a bargain for me. And I didn't have much money, I'll admit. It's not like I had 20 grand to throw around. I mean, I think I had been doing consulting or contracting on the side while I was working a full-time gig, and we lived off.
I mean, you also had Flogs.
Yeah, Flogs, the big, don't rub it in, dude.
You could have sold that domain for $50,000.
Oh my gosh, the amount of time I wasted on that stupid thing. So all my contracting income while I was doing side work, I was putting into this business bank account. And I think there was like somewhere between 12 and 15 grand in it. And so I offered these guys 10 grand for .NET Invoice. Now realizing I way overpaid for it. I mean, it was worth, it had some alpha customers. It was buggy as hell. It was, it took me another couple months to get it to a place where it was actually beta and launchable. So I way overpaid, but I think they countered with 11 grand and I said, fine, let's do it. So I paid 11 grand. I got this piece of shit software. So again, the software looked really nice. It was invoicing software and it had mathematical errors in it. Like it miscalculated tax. And I mean, it was terrible. So I spent a couple months just in there hacking away, fixed all the bugs, emailed the alpha customers, did a launch, and made a few grand from it, which blew my mind that I had just made, that much money from something. After all the toil of these 5 years of launching crappy, ideas, I was like, wow, I think the price was $99 at the time. And then it was $99 and I made a couple grand. I was like, dude, this is insane. Then I tripled the price to $299 and the number of sales per month continued. So suddenly I was making like, it was like 3 grand a month, every month off of this one-time sale software. And that was groundbreaking for me.
Like you mentioned, it's almost pre what we would consider SaaS. Mm-hmm. Did it ever cross your mind, the idea of a subscription at all?
Yeah. Four years later. But the thing was, is that by that time, FreshBooks had launched. There were Simply Bill. I mean, there were a bunch of competitors already doing the SaaS, and we had no differentiation. The reason .NET Invoice sells is because companies want to buy it because they want to have their own source code, or developers wanted to buy it and customize it to use for their clients. So they wanted the source code. That was the thing. The app itself had less functionality as it went on than FreshBooks, right? So there would be no, if we SaaSified it, we'd have to put it up there, then we'd have to build a bunch of features, then we'd have to market it, and how would it be differentiated, you know? So it was, but it was a real, the nice part is by the end, you know, it was $300 per sale, and we only sold 10 copies a month, but it doesn't matter because that's $3,000, and that was enough to way more than make my house payment at the time, you know? And
yeah. Yeah. So was that the only thing you were working on?
From 2005 until 06 or 07, I was all in on that. And I was marketing and doing SEO. That's when I learned how to do SEO. That's when I learned how to do AdWords. That's when I did display advertising. You know, there was no Facebook ads. There was no retargeting, right? It was just before that. And I was working a full-time job. Or between, sometimes I was consulting and then I'd do the full-time job thing, right? Interstitially. But I was always running in the background. And at a certain point, I realized, huh, this is plateaued and I can't push it past this, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 a month point. How am I ever going to quit my job? And that's when I had the realization, I need more than one of these. It's in a tight enough niche. It's not a lot of competition. So it really is kind of on autopilot, aside from some feature builds. You know, it wasn't buggy. The support was easy. Marketing was flywheel. I need more of these. And how many more do I need to quit this job? You know, two or three more, I could probably be done. And so that's what I then went out on the lookout for, was how can I buy or build more things like that, right? That actually had that were easily monetizable, had a real strict path to monetization, and that used my initial, kind of my tool belt that I built. Like if I can beef it out with SEO, if I can beef it out with AdWords or display advertising, then I'm going to do that. And so that became my real quest, was to get enough income to be able to fully be supported by products. And it took me until, I think it was December of 2008, that I kind of worked my last hour. I may have gone part-time on a consulting contract for a couple months and into early 2009, but that was the game changing moment for me.
So at that point, December 2008, how many different sort of products or sites did you have?
That's a good question. I don't remember the exact number, but I know I had .NET Invoice. I had just beachtowels.com, which was an e-commerce site that sold beach towels. It was all drop ship, so I had no inventory. And that was a purely an SEO play. It ranked on the first page of Google. I think I got it up to number 4 in Google for beach towels. It's crazy. Right. Back in the day, you know? And so it sold maybe $2,000, $2,500 a month worth of beach towels. And by the time all the money's taken out for the inventory or for the, you know, to pay the drop shipper and then the support, it literally made $200 to $300 of net profit a month. But and that taught me, like, I don't think I want to do physical products. Yep. The margin is so low, you know? There was beach towels. I'm pretty sure I had Wedding Toolbox by that time, which was just a wedding website builder. CMS Themer, which was a productized service, really, before that term existed. It looked like a SaaS website almost, and you'd come up and it's like $4.95 to turn your PSD to WordPress theme, or PSD to, you know, whatever other, it was like WordPress, Joomla, and Drupal maybe were the three that we were doing. And on the back end, I had folks I was outsourcing to, and I was basically just doing project management, and it was a couple hours a week, and I marked everything up 100%. So that did $4,000 a month, and I made $2,000 profit on it. So it was that stuff. I just cobbled that together to about $8,000 or $10,000 a month. And I think, so I had somewhere between 4 and 6, if I recall, kind of along those lines. I had an ebook as well I had acquired from somebody that was legit. It was about building duck boats, like duck hunting things out of styrofoam or something. And it was like, it had the Home Depot shopping list. And there, I mean, we had testimonials. I had videos of people, you know, actually doing them. And that book sold for, you know, $20 a pop or something. And that alone did $600 a month in like net profit or something. I had nothing. Yeah. Again, it was all an SEO play, you know? And so all my stuff was legit. Like, you know, there was no like trying to rip people off or anything. It all provided some type of value. But it was bizarre and some esoteric things I didn't really have interest in. But to me, it was getting to that angle.
It's super interesting to, like, go back to you as a kid. You were buying candy and reselling it. And like, you're essentially doing like the grown-up version of that.
Right.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Well, yeah. Just trying to
taking something to make that somebody else's. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's nice. You get to sort of skip all of the work to like build the initial thing, and then you get to sort of optimize it. And this, I mean, it's like, you know, you think of like the candy. It's like somebody else made the candy, did all that work, and you just get to sell it, right?
Right.
So, at what point did you decide? Because where does Hittail come in? Was this?
Okay. Yeah, that was 2011, and that was where. So in 2009, 2010, I just put all the apps on autopilot's a loaded word, but I just maintained them. I was trying to grow them with minimal work. So I worked maybe 10, 12, 16 hours a week that time. We had a new kid, a new baby born in 2010. I spent about 8 months with him just hanging on a baby Bjorn. And I worked as little as possible. And it was magical, man. I have zero regret. Like that is some of my favorite times. Sure. Of my life, in all honesty. It was so relaxing, and I'll never get that time back, you know, that I spent with the kid. And during that, also that 2 year window, that's when I'd already been blogging, but that's when I wrote my book and published it. That's when Mike and I started MicroConf. That's when Mike and I started the podcast. And that's when we launched the Micropreneur Academy. All of that happened in that very tight time frame. It was this time of putting out tons of just educational content. And I had realized that I knew enough that it made sense to really start sharing it. I was doing it on the blog already since I started blogging in 2005. But this is when I was like, look, I got to get this stuff out here because I feel like I've realized like how many people know about this. This is a viable solution. It's a viable thing to be able to build a product, to bootstrap it yourself and make a full-time living income, yeah, full-time living off of it. And I'm like living proof, you know, and here are all these case studies and examples. And it that's when really the movement as I see it today really got kicked in was at 2010.
But then what made you go from, you know, you've got all these things that you're sort of maintaining and then also, but at the same time, starting some new things, including being a parent, like what made you want to try again, like again, do the next thing? So Hittail, like keep doing something new.
Yeah. Yeah. What I learned, I thought that once I had all those apps and, or just had the freedom, cause that's what I was going for the whole time, right? That was the goal, was freedom from working for other people. And once I had it, I figured, boy, I'm gonna do that forever. And I'm just gonna, you know, kind of run my own show and just be happy. And it turns out that's true. And it's super awesome to do it, but I got bored eventually. And I was kind of like, what is the purpose here? Like I've now accomplished what I wanted and I'm educating people about it through all those resources I mentioned earlier, but like, what's next? That was what I kept saying was what's next. And I've realized in me about every 18 to 24 months, I need a new challenge because I have to learn new things. Otherwise I get really bored and I get really depressed. And so that's when I was like, all right, I'm going to build a SaaS app, you know, I'm going to build it or buy it. Once again, I went back to that whole drawing board and, I was looking for things to acquire. I evaluated a ton of stuff that was inbound at the time. People were coming to me and I was evaluating them, seeing what I could do with them. And then I was also doing a search for older apps that could potentially, you know, be an acquisition target for me. Again, I didn't have much money. It was all just stuff that was being thrown off from these little micro apps that I was saving on the side. And so I maybe had somewhere around 40 grand in the bank by this point, 50 grand, which is, I shouldn't say that's not much money, but it wasn't like I was, you know, had 500,000-600,000 in the bank. Like it was still a micro thing that I was going to have to get a really real deal on. And I was cold emailing a bunch of these old apps that looked like they'd been abandoned, getting a few replies here and there. And that's how I found Hittail in April, May, somewhere around April or May of 2011. And wound up acquiring it.
How do you, as a, you know, I think of when we had our first kid, like having, if you've got $40,000 or $50,000 sitting in the bank, how did you not spend it on anything else? Like what made you want to just sort of store it up?
Yeah, it's a good question. One thing that we did early on, me and my wife, it was actually her suggestion. Is she said, why don't we figure out how much we need to live on? And you basically take a salary. And this was before I was an LLC. I think I was still,
sole proprietor.
What do you call it? Like a sole proprietor. Yep. Where it all just fed through. So I was every month, I was just pulling all the revenue into our personal account and then we did spend it. But she said, why don't you keep this business account? I can tell that you're going to take money and make money with it is what she said. Like if you have 10 grand, like you went and bought .NET Invoice and now that does 25 grand a year, you know, or 30 grand or whatever it does. She's like, why don't we not spend all the money, figure out what we need to live on. Let's be smart about it. And then whatever is left over goes into that account and you figure out what to do with it, you know? And that's what happened. So that's why that money was stacking up, because we didn't need it. And we had a fine lifestyle. I mean, we were traveling a bit and we owned a home and it was not extravagant. It's probably right. A 2-bedroom, 1-bath, you know, in California, but it was very much a, but you know what? Boy, by 2011, no, we were in like a 4-bedroom house, but that's neither here nor there. It was Fresno, California, which is cheaper to live, but so that was it. So that was the story of it. It was up to between 30 and 40 grand. And it seemed like a ton of money to me. I remember being super nervous about even having that much money. It's like, my parents never had that much money in the bank.
So you know? Used some of that to buy Hittail.
Yep. Wrote a check for 30 grand to buy Hittail, which was very, very hard. It was another one of those pivotal moments. Like you can tell that like .NET Invoice was pivotal for me. And then there were a bunch that came. There were even like CMS Themer made more money than .NET Invoice some months and others of those, but none of them were as pivotal as like .NET Invoice and then Hittail. Like, that was the next level of like, oh good God, this is really scary. And I broke down one night and I wired the money and then I said, I don't think I can do this. Like what if I lose it all? You know? And Sherry was like, A, you're not going to, because you're smarter than that. B, losing it all does not mean you're losing the house. It means you're losing 30 grand that you've worked for, but like you could, you could earn that again, you know? And C, this is what you do. You're a founder, man. You're an entrepreneur. Like you're a guy who takes risks. And if you didn't do this, you would regret. You'd have FOMO like crazy, right? Or regret, I guess, that you didn't, you'd get bored. And so it was a scary moment, but you know, it in the end, it turned out really, it was pretty game changing because that was where our lifestyle grew, not lifestyle grew, but our, like at the time, my income was just a standard, you know, it was around, I'd say it's around, you know, 100 grand, 120 grand a year. That's what I was making from the all cobbling those little apps together. And again, it was a great lifestyle. I was barely working, right? So I was working 12, 16 hour weeks, making 120 grand, which you can live on and own a house in Fresno, California. My wife had a job as well. Hittail was what like whoop, like turned that on its head, right? Where we were no longer like whatever upper middle class. It was like, oh boy, this is a SaaS app, and this is throwing off, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 a
month. And it's just you working
at a certain point.
Yeah,
that was it. I had a couple contractors, so I mean, it was one of those 80% profit margin, 90% profit margin apps, and got it up into the 20, you know, MRR into the 20 to 30 grand for quite some time.
So then the transition from Hittail to you having the idea for Drip. How did Drip come about?
Yeah, it was directly out of Hittail. So I hired a local contractor, a guy named Derek, to help me with copywriting and do some coding and just kind of help maintain Hittail. And at a certain time, I'm like, dude, we get a lot of, like, I was really good at SEO by this point, and it had a really good footprint. So we got a ton of inbound unique visitors. And I said, we should be collecting these on an email list, right? I had implemented email collection for every other one of my apps, and it had always been game changing for it. All, you know, from .NET Invoice to all the other ones I named. And that was always a big deal. And so I was like, look, Hittail has footprint of maybe 200 SEO optimized pages. How are we going to get an email capture widget on all of them without like going in and embedding a form? What if we invented like a Java, not invented, but like use like a JavaScript toaster pop-up widget thing? Because this again was before there was no SumoMe, there was no OptinMonster, there wasn't, you know, none of these things, no Bounce Exchange, they weren't around. So we started talking about it and Derek said, yeah, let me see what I can do. So he hacked together a pretty solid, I think it was all CSS even, yeah, it may have been JavaScript, but he just kind of hacked it together with jQuery, I think. And it was just this snippet of JavaScript we could drop on every page and it would then pop up kind of elegantly, not too much in your face. Cause there were exit intent and there was that kind of stuff, right. But you had to hand code it all. And this was just a nice little thing. We hooked it into MailChimp, put in a little 6-day, 7-day email course, and voila, it like bumped up our trial to paid conversion, went up like 30%. When we did that, just because the course was good and we got enough traffic. And so then I started thinking, how come this is so hard? Why did it take a week of Derek hand coding this stuff to do that? And that's where it came out. It was like, well, maybe we just build that. And if, I don't know if you recall, but like the first version of Drip was the widget. It was autoresponders and it actually integrated with MailChimp and AWeber in case you wanted to send broadcasts or you wanted to like not leave your other accounts. because we were not a full ESP. It was really just this little add-on, much like an Optin Monster, you know?
So what year was that? 2013?
That was December 2012 is when Derek started writing the code. Before he started writing the code, I got 11 people that I knew to say, yeah, I'd pay $50 a month or $100 a month for that. So then Derek starts breaking ground on it, still as a contractor. And then, yeah, we launched it. We did like a slow launch from June to November of 2013, where we would like onboard a handful of people each week. And if they ran into any problems or they were just like, nope, I'm going to quit because of this feature, we'd then build that feature. So it was this very lot of customer development during that time. And then November 2013 was when I emailed the, you know, basically the end of the list. It was about 3,500 people. And that got us up to, I think it was between 7 and 8K of MRR. Kind of in our first production month, even though right. we had been ramping up to that over the previous months.
In your head, maybe before you had gotten to the seven, or even maybe including the when you were at 7 to 8,000 MRR, for you, was Drip going to be just another thing to sort of diversify with? Or by that point, I mean, you were just a in your head, bit. It was just sort of a thing, yep. another thing to do.
Yep. It was another thing to do. And I figured it would be bigger than Hittail. Hittail was great, but it was a low price point. So the churn was high. Google would accidentally just stomp it out of existence every couple months because they just break there were these unpublished APIs that we were tapping into, not provided, really wrecked it. So I realized, we've kind of built it on the back of Google. And this is now my main income source. You know, I had all the other small ones, but this was the big one. And it's like, how long is this a 10-year app at this point? So it was a diversification thing. And it also was, I think that at the higher price point that the churn will be lower and that it can be, you know, some X the size of Hittail, right? So I was thinking, I could make this a seven-figure business eventually was the goal. Somehow, I knew it would just as an add-on to MailChimp, it wouldn't be, but I figured that there was some way we could get it. And that was kind of my goal, was like, yeah, I kind of want to do my, you know, a seven-figure business and see what that's like to build.
So at that point when you guys launched do the official launch in November 2013. Yeah. Was it still just you and Derek?
Yeah, it sure was. And by that time he was W-2 and he didn't have, you know, later he became, I mean, the end of the story, he became my co-founder, right. You know, in 2014, he had written all the code, so it made sense to do it. And he, you know, he took some ownership as well at that point. But yeah, it was just the two of us until, you know, March or April of 2014.
So when you guys are kind of, you feel like you've kind of got the machine going where you're, you know, the thing is working, it's growing. It starts surpassing what Hittail is doing. At that point, did you view yourself as being in competition with like the, Infusionsoft of the world or?
Yeah. MailChimp. MailChimp, that's right. Yep. Yeah. When we passed that, once we had a broadcast sending, and then there were a couple other things we added, and I realized we are becoming an ESP. And then when we added automation, it was like, we are becoming a marketing automation provider, and yeah. we are going to be MailChimp plus, you know, and a competitor to Infusionsoft, an easier to use,
sure.
Infusionsoft was the goal. And I hadn't heard of ActiveCampaign. They really, because they were downloadable until I believe maybe 2014 or 2015.
Oh, wow.
They came on the scene really fast. Yeah. Suddenly they were just there and it was like, oh, what a trip, that these guys are here. But that was the big, Infusionsoft was the 900 pound gorilla, and they were pretty easy to pull people from because everybody hated it.
Sure.
You know, cause it was buggy and stuff. So yeah, definitely MailChimp, AWeber, Infusionsoft were probably the top three that we were getting refugees from.
Did you like the competition with these huge companies that have been around for years, or did you find them just annoying or?
No, I was fine with it, but you know, when you're the upstart, you can move so much faster. So you really do have the advantage there, with MailChimp. So I've always had a ton of respect for MailChimp. I know, Ben Chestnut. And when I say I know him, like when I email him, he replies to me the same day, but it's okay. Like, we've never met in person, and I've invited him to speak at MicroConf several times. He's a good dude. Like I have a ton of respect for how they do business, how they treat their customers, like the whole jam, you know? And so I never took pot shots at them, but people would ask, what are the differences? And it's like, well, we have automation and they don't. And then they eventually launched automation and it was like, well, their automation, just in all honesty, isn't as robust, you know, as ours. So that was not hard. Infusionsoft was, you can imagine how easy of a target that was. Sure. It's like competing with QuickBooks, you know, it's like nobody likes it, but everybody uses it. So that was not, yeah, I wasn't particularly annoyed by them and tried not to annoy them either. I know what it's like to be at a big company or to work at something where it's kind of like you're moving slower and you don't want that little irritating startup, you know, ragging on you. So I tried to be respectful, but it was kind of hard not to call out things like Infusionsoft makes you pay $2,000,
sure,
you know, to get started, and they won't show you the app. There's no trial. I mean, these were easy things that I was able to throw out of like, you should really think about, you know, taking a look at Drip.
Yep. So what does the team look like in let's say 2015? So a couple of years in.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, three developers, myself, and I believe, one customer success, Anna, came on in 2015. I think it was maybe May of 2015. She was customer success slash sales, and she was pretty game changing for us because I was doing sales demos before that and I really didn't enjoy it, and I'm probably not that good at it. And she really upped the game. Oh, and we had a support guy, in remote support guy I'd worked with for years on Hittail and on MicroConf. He had done the support for all of them. So he was going almost full time on Drip by that point. So it was like six people basically.
Got it. And like around that time, we've got six people. What were you guys doing on revenue?
I would have to think back. I'll extrapolate and say, I would bet 50K MRR, 40 to 60 probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
We were starting to grow pretty quickly by that point. Because we got into seven figures, I believe, in 2015. Yeah, I'm pretty sure we did.
Okay.
So
were you guys, I mean, you're just, I guess, sort of hiring as you can afford to.
Yeah, that's right. I hired a little bit out ahead of revenue, and I kind of regretted it later because yeah. it was really stressful. We didn't grow as fast as I wanted.
Sure. So what, I guess at that point, what was the biggest sort of struggle that you guys were having as a company?
Yeah, that's a good question. I remember cash being an issue because I wanted to I wanted more developers. I wanted more customer success people, but we really didn't have the budget for it. So that was a big problem. And that's the struggle of the bootstrapper, right?
Yep.
You perpetually feel like you're underfunded. The growth was awesome. Like it was growing, you know, 5, 10, 15 grand a month. I mean, it was growing really fast, but that put a toll on everything. You know, you just, all of your hosting infrastructure, even though we were on AWS, we were just constantly trying to scale it up to the next level. You know, Drip it's a powerful app, but that means it requires a lot of resources to run all the workflows and all the complexity. And so I remember every 4 to 6 months, we would like stop building features because all hands on deck to like upgrade the database this weekend to this new, you know, AWS size and rewrite this whole analytics thing because we have to cache it all because it no longer runs raw against the database anymore. You know, is that kind of stuff. Yeah. I'd say those are probably the two biggest. So it's like scaling people and scaling technology, right? Yeah. That was it.
So at what point did the conversations with Lead Pages start?
That started in June of 2015. I got an email from Clay Collins, who's the CEO, and he just came out and said, "Hey, Drip looks interesting. I love Drip. You know, would you be interested in selling it?" And I was kind of like, not really, but I mean, I'm always willing to talk about stuff like that. You know, I don't think it's a waste of time. So we, over the course of 18 months in the 2015, 2016 range, we had several suitors approach us, asking to acquire. And I had conversations with all of them, you know, to at least evaluate what it might look like. And I wasn't particularly, you know, and when I say it was like Derek and I, right? We each had ownership, but it was like my personal, you know, view was like, we don't need to sell. We're growing, we're profitable, break even or profitable depending on the month. And there's no dire need to, but it is interesting to think about what life-changing money would look like and whether that'd be worth doing. And, you know, if getting that to that point where you never have to work again was suddenly on my radar because Drip was big enough, right? Once you hit seven figures, it's like, yeah, you could probably sell this thing and have enough money to not work. And, that was a trip with the day I realized that it might be worth that. And so then it was like, okay, I'll have the conversations.
Yeah. So by the time it came down to, you know, you're in the thick of acquisition talks and you're like, it's getting really serious. Well, how many people were on the team then?
That was, there were eight full-time and two contractors.
So when, I mean, for you, was it like, hey, we could, I guess for you, like the motivation, was it really just like, hey, let's, I could sort of like get a nice payday from this? Or
no, by that time, that was the payday was the, was purely the wedge to be like, well, at least I'll have the conversation because that's an interesting thing to think about. Yeah. What ultimately happened was it was just hard to scale the business. And I realized, I think we need to raise a small round of funding, like an angel, like a fund strapping round, right? Where you, I never want to do venture, but like maybe, you know, raise $500,000 again, seven figures growing fast. You know, you can get a decent valuation for that. I would love to have that influx of cash just to stabilize thing. I was super stressed. I was starting to burn out a bit and I wanted to ease off on that. But when Derek and I, the more we talked about it, it's like, dude, if we take that round, it'll make things less stressful now, but like that pushed us out several years of to acquisition because we're going to raise it at a healthy valuation. So we're not going to sell at that valuation, you know, later this year. So which do we want to do? And so we kept debating. And as the talks heated up to acquire, it was like, we're going to do one of these things. You know, that's really what it came down to. It's like, we're either going to raise, cause we just, I think we're going to collapse under our weight here. Yep. Cause grow, you know, again, if you get big and you plateau, it's a lot easier, but that growth is just achy. I mean, there's so many pains getting all the systems up and you know, you just don't tend to have enough money to be able to do it. Yeah. So that was it. So as that escalated, it was like, okay, I think that honestly, in the end, you know, we believed it was truly best for the business. Like it was best for our customers to be able to scale. And it was best for our employees who all got raises because we were paying everybody under market, you know, and the benefits were great once we got acquired. And obviously it was good for the founders because we had a, you know, we did take money out of the business, but that I was really trying to seek that triple win: customers, employees, and us. And then the fourth, of course, is the acquirer. And if you talk to them, I've just talking to some of the C-level guys over there and just, they were like, yes, this was a fantastic acquisition for us. You know, so that was that. I'll admit I was focused on the first three and it was nice to be able to deliver to fourth, you know, in the end, because I just like to keep that reputation in essence.
What was that conversation like with your team about Drip being acquired?
Yeah. We waited. It was about a month before the acquisition. Cause even right up to the end, you just don't know if it's going to fall apart, right? You're still negotiating these deal points. And I was willing to, you know, Derek and I were willing to walk away on many, many occasions. But yeah, I approached him. The nice part is the team was small. And so, I approached several of them individually, right? So I didn't have to have this team meeting where I announced this thing. It was like one at a time, meet. And then Derek and I met with, I think the developers, he and I met with together because we both kind of ran the engineering team, but the other folks I talked to one-on-one. And my first sentence, I've talked about this in the past, but my first sentence was, I'm going to tell you something that's going to sound like bad news, but trust me, I think this is going to be a really good outcome for everyone. You know, I think in the next month, Drip is going to be acquired by LeadPages. I've been talking to Clay Collins. It looks like things are going to go through. So the first two questions you probably have are, one, will I still have a job? And two, do I have to move to Minneapolis, right, where they're located? So the answer is, yes, you will still have a job, and they want to retain you. So the odds are you're going to get a raise. And two, you do not have to move to Minneapolis, but they will pay for you to relocate if you'd like, if that's interesting to you. And from there, I'd give them time to breathe and then would say, you know, what questions do you have? Do you want to know more info? And, you know, what this looks like? And then it'd be this hour conversation of, whoa, this is such a trip. I can't believe it. What's going to change and what's not? And, you know, it was nice that I had a lot of answers because I'd thought through so much of it and that I trusted Clay and the LeadPages team to kind of do right by us because we'd had so many discussions. It wasn't like I was negotiating with their business development guy who's, you know, you imagine IBM, right? Or Microsoft or someone. It's like you deal with this whole business development team. And then when you get acquired, you report to the CEO and he doesn't know anything you talked about. And if it's not in writing, boy, you're screwed. It was not like that, right? Because LeadPages is small enough that I was really dealing with the top decision makers.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it sounds like it was a positive reception from the whole team or most of the team?
Yeah, no one left and everyone was in general really happy. Half the team moved to Minneapolis purely voluntarily. People could stay remote or move there. There was one person on the team who was skeptical. He said, well, I'm willing to stay on, but I've been through one or two of these in the past and things always change eventually. And we were like, okay, that's fair. Now, he still works for, he still works for Drip, you know, or for Lead Pages. And frankly, the first employee to leave was almost 18 months after the acquisition. It may have been like 15, 16 months. To me, that was a success. Like, it wasn't like there was some mass exodus, you know?
Well, the day that the deal closed, was it bittersweet? Was it just, I mean, a party? Like, were you super excited?
It was sweet. There was no bitter. Yeah, there was, the only bitter was my regret of how stressed I had let myself get during the acquisition and kind of how I wasn't, it was probably the one time in, well, I wouldn't say the one, but it was one of the biggest times where I really neglected my relationships. And I I was not a great parent or husband for that 4 or 5 months of the hard negotiation. So that was the bitter part. But when it closed, it was a huge sigh of relief because it was over. Sure. And I knew, I mean, Derek and I had been thinking about it since June of the prior year, right? At least evaluating it, trying it on for size. There was no regret. Like, I'm not an impulsive person. And there has not been a single day that I have woken up and thought, you know what? I wished we hadn't sold. Never, never once. And I asked Derek, we were at beers a few months ago, and I asked him the same thing. You know, do you ever regret it, man? He's like, no way. Like, it was the right move. And not because, oh, I needed to get rid of Drip, or, oh, it really sucked. It wasn't any of that. It was just one of those things where I think it was the right decision, you know? And I truly believe everybody won from it. And it's nice to be able to do that. It's also nice. I like to do new things, right? As you've heard, and going through an acquisition like that, and that, you know, from another startup that had raised, Lead Pages raised 38 million, then to work for them and to see their experience and to be on the inside of that and to be like, oh, this is how it's different. There are pluses and minuses of having 38 million in funding. And, you know, my MicroConf talk this year is, as I think you may have seen at Growth, was exactly that. It was just me analyzing that and looking at it from, no, I've been an outsider and an insider, you know, and that whole, I wouldn't have done it just for that experience, but it really was enlightening to me, and learning is always something that excites me.
I do think, like, the getting to see, you know, how the proverbial sausage is made at companies that are just on a completely different scale, is super valuable. Even if you don't, you know, maybe even if you didn't like the experience or didn't like some of the decisions that are made, like, just seeing how people approach doing something at scale is insightful regardless.
I agree. Lead Pages had 45,000 customers or something like that when they acquired
us.
So
many.
Right? And to us too. And it's like, oh, they got to do things really differently. And so, yeah, it was definitely enlightening to me.
Yeah. So you were at, after the acquisition, you stayed at Lead Pages for 2 years, and just last month or so you left Drip. So
that's right.
What's the plan for the future?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was trying to think of it the other day. I think I was there about 20 or 21 months, and totally amicable. It's just time, right? It's time. 5.5 years on a single app. It's like, that's like a third of my career, man. So Derek and I both, you know, left within a couple months of each other, and it was just decided to move on to the next thing. For me right now, I'm taking time off. Like, I am doing a lot of writing. I redid my home, you know, my blog, which was ancient, and now it's robwalling.com. I got a new domain name. I bought it from the other Rob Walling and had somebody redesign it. And that was just been a fun project to do. And then I've been writing a lot. So I may turn into a book. I'll just see what it turns out. I'm about 10 or 11,000 words into kind of the story of Drip. You know, I looked and I said, what were the most dramatic moments? Like, the most stressful ones, the highs, the lows, the agony, the ecstasy, all that. And I've made a big list of them, and I'm just hammer. Each of those is right now is a chapter or a long blog post, depending on what they wind up. And we'll see if it turns into a whole book or if it's a blog series or whatever. That to me is the extent of what I want to commit to for about the next six months. You know, I don't have the energy or desire right now to build or to acquire anything else. And I don't know that I ever will, but you never know, right? Never know what will happen. I'm also spending a lot of time with my kids. I'm homeschooling them in the afternoons right now. I run around the lake a lot here in Minneapolis, and managing investments now. That became a whole, I love managing investments, but once you have, once I got more money, it became even more fun, you know, because right, like I can diversify into all these things. Cause it's not like, I have 50K to invest. It's like, no, I have money, you know, you can put in things. So I am enjoying myself. I will eventually get bored if I don't tackle another, you know, another high learning experience, but I just don't know what that is yet.
So what are the chances we'll see Flogs come back?
Oh my goodness. I wonder if I still have that domain. That's a killer idea. I'm going to revisit that. Right.
That or just beach towels.
Just beach towels. I sold just beach towels.
No, I know.
Can you believe it? I should go back and try to get that back. Cause that could be,
Man, go buy back all of the things
all
that you sold.
Things.
Just like you have this like weird nostalgic bent. Like
oh
just,
my gosh.
Some form of therapy.
I will say that some of my form of therapy recently has been, since the acquisition, is I have one of my diversifications of my assets is to, I wanted to put just a tiny percentage of my net worth into collectibles. And I was looking at art and I'm like, I don't really get art, but I realized that like old comic books are really expensive, right? Like Amazing Spider-Man number one, Fantastic Four number one. And this is the stuff I could never own as a kid because I didn't have the money. And so that I have bought a handful of really pretty high grade, fairly expensive comic books. And I love it. I love it. I look at these things all the time because it's just this, it harkens back to my childhood, but it's also kind of like things come full circle, right? It's like I was selling comic books, you know, in junior high, and now I'm able to kind of have this thing and still be connected to the hobby. So it's been fun.
Yep. That sounds fun. Well, cool, man. Well, that is all I have got. How can people get in touch?
Yeah. If people hit robwalling.com, they can find out about all the stuff I'm up to and I'll be updating. I have a kind of an essays section that is essentially my blog that I'll probably start posting to again here in the next couple months with my newfound thoughts on startups and such.
Cool. Right on. Well, thanks so much, Rob. This was a ton of fun.
Absolutely, man. It's my pleasure.
All right, there we have it, Rob Walling of Drip. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I would love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@baremetrics.com, or on Twitter @Spigford. Head to founderchats.com to listen to dozens of other conversations with startup founders. And if you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes or sharing this with your friends goes a long way. Thanks again. See you next week.